This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
Double beat. Here we go. It is once again Thursday, 1 o'clock, and you have tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You are listening to the Farm Report, and I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today we are on the line with Dan and Margot Brooks. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, Erin.
Hey, so glad to have you. So, Marco, I know we've had you on the show before. You are currently one of the herd managers for Consider Bardwell Farm and a sixth-generation farmer. And Dan is your father, who farms right next door at Wayward Goose Farm. And Dan is a fifth-generation farmer. And what I'm excited to kind of have you guys both on the show today, because I think you represent this really interesting story of transition with regards to dairy farming in New York State. And Dan, I think we're going to start with you. Now, you grew up on a dairy farm and ran a conventional dairy farm for, I think, 27 years. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the farm you were operating prior to Wayward Goose.
Yeah, it was a family farm, and we expanded in the early 90s, I think. And before that, we ground our own feed, made our own, grew corn, but we used it all to grind our own feed, and we were milking around 50 cows. And then we expanded and built onto the barn and made it a 92-cow herd. And so then we couldn't grow enough corn to grind our own feed anymore and had to buy regular mixed feed. And we grew a lot of corn for corn silage. And we also had some beef cows and a lot of land, a lot of woods.
So you said you were milking at that point about just over 90 head. And I think the New York State average is right around 100. And so in that operation, where was the milk going?
The milk was going to Cabot or Agrimark.
They're a regional dairy cooperative. So can you tell us a little bit about what that relationship looks like? I mean, one of the things we've had a couple of discussions with cow dairy farmers over the past couple of years on the show. And, you know, one of the things that's always striking to me is how many different tasks there are and things that you need to, as a business owner, need to be on top of. And I think you hit on some of those. One, obviously taking care of and milking the cows, but also a lot of dairy farmers in New York State work hard to grow their own crops for feed for the cows, and then but are somewhat divorced from kind of the end product. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, you are in the milking parlor milking the cows, and then what happens kind of to the milk after that point?
Yeah, on the farm I was on, it was it was all went into one big tanker truck, and so every farm's milk is mixed together, and it got to me so that it didn't feel like I was doing something that was something that I could be proud of. I guess we had quality milk awards and things like that, but I knew our milk just got mixed in with everyone else's milk, and I, you know, I wasn't involved in the end product as I am here. It's a lot different here, where our milk goes to make the cheese, and we actually help take care of the cheeses in the caves, and so we actually have a really good connection to the end product, and that makes us feel really good.
Can you talk, what are some of those, I mean, as far as milk quality, you know, what are we talking about? I'm assuming, you know, when you're selling into Agrimart that, you know, they're not going to pull up and take just anything. I mean, there are kind of metrics that you needed to hit. Can you talk about what some of those are?
Yeah, there's a legal limit for somatic cell count and for bacteria, and then, you know, if you're over the legal limit, they won't even take your milk, so everybody has to be under that. And then Agrimark also was paying a premium for milk that was under a certain somatic cell and bacteria count. And then on top of that, you get premiums for protein and butterfat, I believe.
Okay. What is it? Can you tell me, just because I'm not familiar, a somatic cell is, what is that referring to? What's that a measurement of?
It's supposed to be a measurement of, like, if, well, I don't know exactly how to state it. It's it could show that a cow has some sort of an infection if there's a cow that had a really high somatic cell count.
Okay.
So
it's kind of a threshold. They set a threshold of kind of an acceptable level. I mean, because milk is, you know, a live kind of raw product. It is going to have a level of bacterial content, which is something you want, kind of. But there's good bacteria and bad bacteria. So basically, those tests are measuring kind of what is an acceptable level for that milk, in addition to the protein and the butterfat content. Because Agrimart, now they are taking that milk to produce cheese, but they also sell fluid milk. Is that right?
I believe they do, yes.
And
as far as I know.
The other topics that we've touched on here is in this model where you're selling into a cooperative, one of the things I think that's really great about that is you have a consistent outlet for your product. I mean, cows are, you know, once they're milking, it's not like you can turn a lever and shut them off. So you need kind of something to do with that milk every day, and having this relationship with the co-op allows you kind of a steady outlet for your product. But the kind of corollary of that is with the pricing that you get. And can you talk a little bit about how you got paid or how that price was set for the milk that you were producing on your previous farm?
Yeah, that's it. I could try, but it's complicated. I know there's a whole formula based on, you know, how far you are from Boston and the somehow they set the price every month for the milk, and, you know, I never exactly understood it.
But you were essentially a price taker, I guess, is my point, in that they said this is what you're getting paid, and your ability to kind of bargain or barter or I think essentially really recognize a premium for a premium product was fairly limited.
Yeah, that's true. And there was a lot of fluctuation. You know, there would be times when the milk prices were really good, and it seems like when those times happen, then a lot of people expand, and then before long the price goes back down really low, and the highs were getting higher and the lows were getting lower, it seemed like.
So from a management perspective, that sounds really stressful, because essentially all of that is out of your control, more or less.
Yeah, it is stressful. It's it's hard to know what to expect, you know. And you can keep track of the markets, but there are some ways you can limit your risk if you know how to do that, but that's complicated also.
yeah, I'm getting that impression. So, Margo, you grew up on this dairy farm, and you left to go to college, and then I know now that you're working at Consider Bardwell, and we've talked a little bit through kind of your path to get there on previous shows, but maybe you can recap kind of quickly, you know, how you ended up at Consider Bardwell and maybe why you chose not to go back to the family farm, or tell us a little bit about that decision process.
Sure. Sure. So I went away to college. I went to St. Lawrence University, which is way up in northern New York. And I was a biology major, and I was really interested in sort of conservation biology. And as I sort of went through my 4 years and towards the end of my college tenure, I started to realize that I was still really interested in my family's farm, and every time I'd go home on breaks, I was just blown away by how big it was and sort of the diversity that was there, and I just was pulled back more and more to the farm and farming, and I realized that I could really make an impact if I took my conservation biology ideas and all the things I had learned and went back and applied that to a farming setting. And and I was interested in my farm in particular because it did have this diversity at one point. You know, my great-grandfather and before that, they had a lot of diversity on the farm. There were apple orchards and bees and sheep and cows, and then as time went on, those things sort of fell by the wayside and things just got focused on sort of this monoculture idea of the dairy, and because that was what was the most profitable, and it was what was being pushed by, I don't know, by the government, I guess, or, you know, it's just the trend. So I did want to go back to my family's farm, and I thought the way to do that would be to learn how to make a value-added product first. So I found this job at Consider Bardwell Farm. It was just perfect timing and a well-timed email, and I got a job as a cheese maker here in 2008, right out of college, and I spent a year and a half making cheese. And then conversation started to come up with, you know, I went back home and started the conversation about maybe going back and trying to build a little creamery and maybe expand into some goats. And the farm wasn't just my father running it. It was him and his brother, and they were the two brothers that were owners in the whole thing. And it just was clear at that point that it wasn't going to work out. There were conflicting ideas about the direction that the farm should take. And so at that point, I realized I wasn't going to be able to live out my dream of going back to the family farm and make, you know, doing my own thing there. And at that point, my dad sort of realized that that was the end for him there, too, because if his kids couldn't come back and have a part in it, then he didn't really want to be there either. So then we started looking at other options, and in 2011, last January, my parents bought the farm right next door to Consider Bardwell and moved in, and so that's where we are now.
Wow, and there's like a great piece on how the farm kind of got its name, and I would encourage listeners to the Farm Report to check that out on the previous episode that you were on, Margo. But Dan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, after kind of growing up and spending your entire life on this one piece of property in this farm, what it was like essentially to be kind of out on the market looking to purchase a new piece of land? I mean, I think one of the things that comes up a lot as farms are looking to transition is kind of just the story here is how do you include the next generation and continue to support the generation that currently is actively working the farm? And, you know, you made that decision to kind of look for a new piece of property. So can you talk a little bit about what the market looked like and what were some of the factors that went into your decision making? Because Wayward Goose now, you guys are milking, I think, 20 cows. Is that right? 20 Jerseys. So it was a big shift from the environment that you had been working in previous to that.
Yeah, it was a very stressful time looking for farms. It was you know, a lot of farms we looked at would have something we liked, but the, you know, a lot of the farmhouses were really not in good shape, and we had my wife Lori and I had spent a lot of time already fixing up the house that my grandparents owned, which was really run down, and we really didn't want to have to do that And so we were looking for a place that where we wouldn't have to spend a lot of time and energy and money fixing up a house. So that was one of the things that we agreed on. And I also spent a lot of time on the soil website, because you can see any piece of land and see what the soils are like. So I was trying to find a place, you know. I said if we were going to buy a place, we should buy a place that at least had good soil. And the farm that we ended up with doesn't have great crop soil, but it's really nice pasture land, and so that worked out for us.
And so is the soil site, I mean, is that, I know for a land to be in like an agricultural assessment for tax purposes, the soil has to be categorized and there's different levels of quality. Is that the site you're talking about, or what, I mean, where, what were you looking at as far as, like, how did you know that that existed, or if someone else was kind of in your shoes now, what would they go to look at some of that similar information?
I think it's the USDA Soil Service site. I think that's what it's called. And you can actually draw lines around the piece of property that you're looking at on there. It's very interactive once you figure out how to use it. And you can section off one field or one piece of property, and it'll tell you exactly what soil types they are and what will grow good there, and it's really helpful if you're looking for land.
Sure, and that's linked to lands that are available for sale, or that's just kind of a categorization of all New York State land?
No, it's not just land that's for sale. I don't think it's just New York State land either. I think it's a national thing.
Interesting.
As far as I know.
Wow, so we are going to take a short break, and when we get back, I want to tuck into a little bit more about what your production looks like now that you're on Wayward Goose Farm. So hold tight. We will be back in one moment.
The following program was sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards and Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards and Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
Okay, we're back. You are tuned into the Farm Report, and we are talking dairy with Dan and Margot Brooks. Both are raising animals for milk production for Consider Bardwell Farms. So at Consider Bardwell, they make a number of cheeses, and no small feat, the cheeses have been really well received. I know, you know, the American Cheese Society has awarded you guys with a couple, I think, best in shows and first places. And so the cheese that you're producing there is obviously at a very high level, and you do goat's milk cheese and cow's milk cheese. So the two farms are working in partnership for milk production. And then, Dan, you said you were also doing some work in the cheese caves?
Yeah, my wife, Lori, and I both work in the cheese caves. I take care of the Rupert that they make. Have to flip each wheel once a week, and the younger cheeses have to be brined each week. And they're 40 to 50, 60-pound wheels.
Wow.
And they just built another cave to store those in, and they seem to be expanding, and the cheese is doing really well.
That's great. So as a producer, you know, when you're kind of going from this larger model where your milk is essentially being picked up every day and you have no real relationship with the end product, can you talk about how how you're on the farming side of things, like how having this relationship with the end product has changed the way you work with the animals, or how those, I guess that's the end of my question, honestly.
Yeah, we have a lot of visitors here because we are right next to Consider Bardwell, so, you know, we try hard to keep things looking really nice and have the cows so they're visible to the people that stop in. We also sell raw milk here from our farm, and we get a lot of, you know, a lot of visitors, so it does, and we're also animal welfare approved, so that's a big part of, you know, it helps add value to our products, and eventually may add value to the cheeses.
And as far as, you know, working with a herd of 20 versus a herd of 90, how has that been a difference for you? I mean, does it mean that you will only have to work like a quarter as hard?
Well, there is a lot less, but it's still, you know, you still have to be there both ends of the day to milk the cows. That's now no different, and it seems like it still takes me 2 hours to milk, even though I'm only milking 20 cows by the time I feed calves and do everything else. And our milk room where we sell milk is also connected right to our milking parlor, so we always make sure that's, you know, nice and clean for visitors when they stop in. And a big difference is that with 20 cows, if they're going down a laneway, they make a whole lot less mud than 90 cows do, and that's nice, and it's easier to move them around, and it's really enjoyable working with the Jersey herd that we have. They're really friendly and easy to work with, and now that they've been here a year and are used to our situation, they're really, really milking well this spring.
Can you talk about that? I mean, you're working with Jerseys now, but what breed were you working with previously?
We had mostly Holsteins, but we also had some crossbreeds. We had a few linebacks and some milking shorthorn crosses, and I was trying to cross some of the frailer type Holstein cows to Brown Swiss to make them a little stronger, and we were rotational grazing the cows there too, so you know, that's not a lot different. I was used to that and had a pretty good feel for when to move cows on the grass and things like that.
Well, that's one of the things I've heard about, like heard in, I guess, in defense of larger scale dairies who don't do, you know, who aren't doing any grazing, especially for the animals that they're milking, because the milk picks up flavors from what the cows are eating, and so you have this kind of variety of flavors that was essentially seen, could be seen, I think, as a negative in the fluid milk market, but that, I guess, would be a positive in the cheese world as you're looking to kind of see some seasonality between the milk. I mean, it is a product that shifts throughout the year. I mean, is that something that you have noticed? And I guess it has. You guys have been milking for a year now, so have you picked up any trends throughout the year or any different flavor profiles from the milk that you kind of can see reflected in the cheese?
I don't see a lot of difference. We did just put a sign up on our milk fridge for our raw milk, that just to warn the customers that they might notice a little bit of a grassy taste while the cows are out on grass the first thing in the spring and the pastures are really lush. But we haven't really noticed it yet. I've just put a sign up to let people know that it could happen. And actually, the head cheesemaker, Peter Dixon, was talking about some of the cheese places actually keep track of what pastures their cows or sheep or whatever they're making cheese from graze on, and they have people that want only cheese that came from a certain pasture.
Oh, wow. You're, like, really dialed into what you like. I mean, what a luxury.
Right.
Marco, maybe because you have been working, you know, in your lifetime, you've worked extensively with cows, but also with goats. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the differences between the two animals and I don't know if there are different decisions or like how the things that impact the milk differently between.
Sure. Well, the biggest differences I see are, you know, the goats are a little smarter and, well, my dad might bristle at this, but I think they're smarter and they have more personality. I've always been a goat person. So that also makes them a little bit harder to contain within fencing. They're pretty wily. They get out easily, so that creates a management issue. My dad can put up one single strand of electric fence and keep cows in, and we have to have, you know, a netting of fence to keep the goats in. And, you know, different things. The poop factor is a big one. They have a much cleaner poop, a much more manageable poop. It's just these little milk duds, basically.
They really do look like milk duds.
Yeah. So when a goat poops in the milking parlor, I can just, you know, I could pick it up in my hand and not even get my hand that dirty and just toss it in the garbage. And so that's a big difference. And it actually, you know, it's a big part of a farmer's day is just managing the waste that comes out of these animals. So they're much more manageable in that way and things stay a little cleaner. And one of the bigger things, too, is that they are seasonal breeders. So they breed in the fall, all of them. They all come into heat at the same time, and then they kid in the spring. And when they have their kids, they have usually 2 to 3 per animal, as opposed to the cows, which will have 1 calf, sometimes 2, but that's not very often. And so that makes a big management difference for us. You know, my dad's breeding his cows year-round and calving year-round. He's not having this big influx of calves. And we have, right now, we're raising 150 kids, right? So that's a big management issue for us. And, you know, just the milk factor, they make a lot less milk per animal. It would take about 7 of our goats to make the amount of milk that 1 of my dad's cows can make. So you have to have more, but they're smaller, and I can, you know, manage them a little easier
than that.
Physically, yeah.
Sure. And now I know to be animal welfare approved that one of the requirements is that you have to raise all your young stock on the farm. And Margo, I know that you and Alex are raising the goats and the animals that you're not going to be used as replacements for your milking herd for the No Goat mm-hmm. Left Behind project to sell into restaurants down here in the city. But Dan, when you have a male calf is born on the farm, how do you manage that end of things, and what's the outlet for those animals?
Well, we're currently raising 7 calves for veal, feeding them real milk, and I've started breeding. Unless I'm positive I want to raise a calf out of a cow, I breed some of the cows to Angus so that they'll grow better veal calves. And I don't foresee that I'm going to need a huge amount of replacement dairy cows for our farm because I think they're going to last really well. Our setup seems to work really well. They stood the winter good, and so I'm, you know, trying to manage things by breeding to a beef breed so we can grow some better veal. And the Jersey veal actually is very good, and they grow well too, but the ones that are crossed with Angus really fill out quickly and make nice veal, so that's what we're doing at the present time.
So I know veal, I think in some circles is a real kind of dirty word, and I think there's been a lot of coverage in the media of some pretty brutal living conditions for veal. I mean, with particular regards to, you know, confinement. I'm assuming, you know, through the animal welfare approved process that but that those, you know, is not something as a consumer that we would need to be concerned with. Can you, like, what qualifies veal as veal? Is it just an age thing? Or, I mean, what does that really mean? Like, what's the demarker for that name?
Well, to me, it generally means that they're mostly fed milk. I think the commercial veal farms, you know, they keep them in a really confined space and give them a lot of milk, but it's usually milk replacer. And our veal calves are raised in group pens, which is something animal welfare approved requires. They don't want them raised in pens by themselves, so ours are in a group, and they have a group feeder that they eat out of, and we also feed them some hay and some grain, so it's not probably like traditional veal. It's more like a rose veal or something like that, because with regular veal, commercial veal, they're fed only milk, so they don't really develop a rumen to digest hay and grain and things like that, but our calves are fed some hay and grain to develop their rumen, and the meat doesn't come out white like it does with a commercial veal. It's more of a rosy color, but it has really nice flavor.
Nice. So, Margo, you grew up, you left home, moved on to another farm, and then somehow are still living, you know, within walking distance of your parents in West Paulet, Vermont, this tiny little town. What do you guys do up there, you know, for fun? Like, what's happening? Is there any activities or events during the week, or how do you fill your time when you're not, you know, busy taking care of the animals?
Well, there's not a lot of that time for us. People always ask us that, and it just seems like it's just never an issue because we just never have time to kill. But yeah, there are quite a few things going on, and there are a lot of other farmers around here, so we're able to have a pretty good social life with a lot of the other young farmers that are doing some cool things around here. And there are a lot of farmers markets and places where you can go and get some interaction with the community. In fact, there's one right in West Paulet. It's on Friday nights. It's a great little market, and there are a few veggie vendors and a bunch of different prepared food vendors, so it's a great place to go since there aren't a lot of restaurants around here. It's a great place to go and get some good food on Friday night and just see everyone and socialize a bit.
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to your mom, actually. I took a trip up through Vermont a few weeks ago and was able to stop and catch that market and snag a piece of her pineapple pie, which was delicious. So if anyone finds himself, you know, within an hour's drive of West Paulet, I'd say it's worth the trip. It's a real kind of slice of life. But if you want to get some cheese or some of the veal or other products, I mean, where can people find you guys?
If you're in the vicinity of West Paulet, you can always come right down to the farm, and you can buy the cheese. We have our free-range eggs for sale there, and right next door is Wayward Goose Farm, where they sell their raw milk and homemade pies on the weekend. Usually there's some pies for sale down in the milk cooler. And you can also get the veal right here on the farm. But other than that, in New York, we're considered Bardwell Farm is in many, many markets. I don't even know the ones. They're on the website. You can find them on considerbardwellfarm.com, the different markets that we're a part of. And we also are selling the Wayward Goose Farm animal welfare approved veal at those markets too. So you can try that if you want.
Oh, and I do. Dan and Margo, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us on the Farm Report today. It was great to get a chance to hear a little bit more. I feel like there's so many great stories up at Consider Bardwell, so I'm sure we'll have you guys on again soon to talk about goats or dairy or conservation, any of the myriad of issues that you're tucking into. So thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Aaron.
Awesome. Tune in next week at 1 o'clock for another episode of The Farm Report, coming to you live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.